Good evening, and I'd like to welcome you here to the Hong Kong Theatre, and for those of you who are from outside the LSE, to the London School of Economics. My name is Tony Travers, and I'm one of the deputy directors, I think it is, of the Cities Programme, never exactly sure of the nomenclature. And I'm the chair for this evening of this Jane Jacobs Lecture. The Jane Jacobs Lectures are, for obvious reasons, named after the great urban writer of that name. And this evening we're going to hear from a politician, a London politician, but who's had a national remit. And he, sitting here on my left, is Chris Smith. Chris Smith is almost, I suppose, is a local MP in the sense that the LSE has quite a lot of local MPs, given the way the constituencies are drawn, though not our MP. Islington South and Finsbury ends up sort of about half a mile, three quarters of a mile away from here at its closest point. Chris Smith has been MP for Islington South and Finsbury for a number of years, but crucially, in terms of what he's going to talk about tonight, which is culture and regeneration, he was Secretary of State for Culture, Media and Sport in the earlier years of this government, indeed when the government was very much more popular than it is today, for whatever reason. And so perhaps I can, with no more ado, invite you, Chris, to speak tonight. And what we'll do is Chris will speak for 30, 35 minutes, and then we'll have a response from Michael here, who may or may not respond, he says, and then we'll have an opportunity for debate involving those of you from the floor. But Chris, thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Tony. At heart, Jane Jacobs' vision was that urban communities need life, work, entertainment, engagement, and culture, as well as a good physical fabric. It is perhaps therefore appropriate that I take as a central theme for this lecture the ways in which we can look beyond the physical when we come to consider the shape of our urban centres in the years ahead. Physical quality is, of course, important, indeed essential, if cities are to thrive and to be livable, but it isn't enough. And how exactly do we set about embracing the rest of life into our cities? Can it be done by anything other than millions of individuals meeting and interacting and enjoying themselves? These are some of the questions that I want to explore this evening. Incidentally, I note in passing that Jane Jacobs also wanted to wage war on suburban commuting drivers, putting, for example, as many traffic lights as possible in their way, something Transport for London has become rather good at. I think she might have warmed to the idea of congestion charging. Here in Britain, over the last 6 years, and thanks largely to the proceeds of the National Lottery, we have had a remarkable period in which a series of large cultural projects have come to fruition. Some have been hugely successful, far outstripping expectations. Some have not, and I'll return to some of the reasons why in a moment. Many have helped to transform the cities they are in. Think, for example, of the Lowry Centre in Salford, and compare what is happening there and around it with the derelict, wind-blown area of deserted docks that was there before. Think of the way the Baltic Flour Mills, the Music Centre and the New Millennium Bridge are combining to change the Tyneside areas of Newcastle and Gateshead beyond recognition. Think of the impact that Tate Modern and the Globe Theatre have jointly had on a previously nondescript part of the South Bank in London. And there are countless other examples. I don't think we yet comprehend fully the importance of what we have done as a nation over recent years. We have put in place a sea change in the cultural infrastructure of the country. we will have left an abiding legacy for successor generations, and we should be proud of having done so. A few years ago, many might have said, look at the success of Bilbao, it couldn't happen here. Well, it has happened, it is happening, and not just in one place, but in many. We haven't always got it right, of course. Think of the Popular Music Centre in Sheffield. Wonderful architecturally, but turning out to be a disaster in practice. Think above all of the Dome, a beautiful building and space that launched 1,000 contemptuous commentaries. Why do some great cultural buildings work spectacularly well and others don't? I want to explore what does assist a process of regeneration and what doesn't, to see what lessons we can learn, to think about where public policy should therefore be taking us, to conjure a few aspirations as a result. And I want to look at this with particular reference to the past and future of one specific cultural institution here in London, the South Bank Centre. Before I do, however, let's look a bit wider. When Salford Borough Council took the brave and lonely decision to help the regeneration of the old Salford Quays by creating a centre for the performing arts dedicated to the memory of their native son, L.S. Lowry, many people thought they were mad. It took a lot of time, a lot of patience, some lucky breaks with both the Millennium Commission and the Arts Council Lottery Fund, and endless persistence, coupled with a design that stands dramatically at the edge of the canal. But what has emerged has been worth the trauma. It is a rare example of truly visionary local government taking risks and emerging triumphant. It happens all too seldom, both in local government and in national government. The quality of artistic work being put on at the Lowry is high. People are coming, especially in their droves, to look around the building and simply savour the architecture and the atmosphere. An existence on one side of the canal has inspired Daniel Libeskind to create the Imperial War Museum of the North in Trafford on the other. Remarkably, this is a building done without any input from the lottery at all, and if anything, the architectural concept based on broken shards of the Earth's crust is even better than the Lowry. The presence of the Lowry has also begun a wider process of regeneration too. A large hotel has been created nearby. Housing is coming. Life is returning to the area of dereliction. All of this appears to be textbook win-win regeneration. You put a marvellous new cultural building in place, and the spin-off effect helps to generate construction, economic activity, and ultimately a new quarter for the city. And to a large extent, that is true. There is one cloud on the horizon, and it serves to remind us of a wider dilemma for cultural institutions generally. Huge numbers of people are visiting the Lowry, but not enough of them are actually crossing the threshold to experience an artistic performance. They come for the feel of the place, for the coffee bars and the views across the canal, for the promenade on a sunny Sunday afternoon. They don't come in the same numbers to hear the music or see the dance or experience the theatre. Finding ways of welcoming people readily through the door, making them feel not just that the building belongs to them, but that so does the activity going on inside it. This is the challenge, and it is something that applies to other great cultural buildings too. The Royal Opera House in Covent Garden is an obvious case in point. The complex of buildings that emerged from the redevelopment of the Opera House has created some truly beautiful yet practical spaces for opera, for ballet, for technicians, and for the audience. Leave aside for a moment the perception that at Covent Garden, the three tenors is what you pay for a glass of champagne in the floral hall in the interval. The conundrum of how to make the visitor who is not familiar with the place and perhaps not familiar with opera or ballet take the decision to come in and enjoy a performance is a real one. We know that given the opportunity, there are many people who respond warmly to the excitement and emotion and uplift of an artistic performance, even if it is their first such experience. We can see the effect that the Hamelin Nights have at Covent Garden and the National Theatre. But how do you give them the sense that this sort of activity is for them? You can do it in part by making it truly affordable. Nick Heitner's bold experiment this coming summer at the National of £10 tickets every night in the Olivier Theatre is exciting and radical. You can do it by how welcoming you make the entrance architecture. It is for strangers to come in to feel at home, find their way around. The Barbican take note. You can do it by filling the foyer with interesting activities, as the Festival Hall has consistently done for years. You can do it by intelligent and compelling marketing. All of this will help. But we have to recognize that changing attitudes, changing the culture of perception about artistic activity, will only happen gradually, if at all. We shouldn't force the pace, but we should make it easier for those welcoming things to be done. If the burghers of Salford were taking a bold step when they launched the regeneration of the quays on the back of a palace of culture, the councillors of Gateshead were making an even wilder move when they agreed with the Arts Council that a huge Anthony Gormley sculpture should be commissioned. They were reviled for doing so. Incidentally, so were the Paris authorities when the Eiffel Tower was built, and so was the city of Sydney when the design for the Opera House was unveiled. The Angel of the North, however, is now not only an accepted part of the Tyneside landscape, but an enthusiastically embraced icon of the region. It was also the start of something even more remarkable in Gateshead and Newcastle. The old Baltic flour mills have been transformed into a glorious gallery space. A new music centre has been created, and linking them all, the new Winking Eye Bridge, which echoes the old, but is nonetheless emphatically new. The development of this relatively small number of major projects has been remarkably significant in giving the whole of the Twin Cities a sense that they have a new lease of life. They have launched a determined bid to become European Capital of Culture in 2008. Indeed, the seriousness with which the shortlist of cities is taking the Capital of Culture competition, far beyond any expectations I had when I initially launched it, is testament to the power that such a designation has to draw in people and events, and therefore economic return. What above all has been brought to the Newcastle-Gateshead area by these projects is something more indefinable. They have helped to make people feel proud about themselves and their city. And in any process of regeneration, that is both an essential ingredient for success and also a product of it. It becomes, in the best circumstances, a virtuous circle. What local authorities like these are engaged in, of course, is nothing less than fostering a good old-fashioned bit of civic pride. It is easier to do in cities outside London, perhaps partly because we have too much ceased in recent years to regard London as a discrete entity, but also because we tend to regard great civic projects in London as being national in relevance rather than regional. We both gain and lose in this equation. Cities like Newcastle and Gateshead are embarked, in fact, on a rather Victorian enterprise of giving shape and form and identity to their city and their people by undertaking major civic works. But in Victorian times, this was something city authorities could afford to do. Nowadays, they can't. That is why the lottery, European funds, private sector involvement, and very occasionally, when the Chancellor allows it, national government support are all required. There are some who say that it is all very well to create the great schemes and to foster a sense of regional identity by doing so, but can we really trust the analysis that says that there is an economic gain to be had from all of this? To them, I would say, go to St. Ives. This may seem an odd example to throw into a discussion of cities, because something less like a city than a glorious Cornish fishing village bathed in pellucid light beside a lapping sea is hard to imagine. But it has one very important lesson to demonstrate to us. When the Tate created its new gallery at St. Ives, drawing on the fact that there was a thriving and distinguished artistic colony based there already, and drawing also on the fact that there was a captive tourist market already in place, they did not quite expect the explosion in visitor numbers to the village that the opening of the new gallery would generate. The figures are difficult to quantify, and I would not want to claim that this was a rigorous analysis. It is also important to discount the impact of the last 2 years of foot and mouth and the aftermath of 9/11 on tourism generally. But what seemed to happen in the first 5 years or so of the Tate St. Ives existence was that economic activity in St. Ives grew by some 25% over that period. More people came, so spending went up, and as well as seeing the gallery, they did other things too. But also the existence of the gallery and the presence of greater numbers of visitors ensured that other spin-off activities, private galleries, studio tours, art discovery holidays, and so forth, began to develop. The virtuous circle, starting from the catalyst of the big project, began to occur. In the case of St. Ives' big sibling, Tate Modern, on Bankside here in London, the spin-off effects are more difficult to identify, although it does seem to a layman's eye that something of significance has been happening along that part of the South Bank as a result of the appearance of both Tate Modern and the Globe Theatre in such close proximity. The new and utterly graceful Millennium Bridge helped too. As chairman of the Millennium Commission, I was fond of saying that we had opened the first new bridge over the River Thames in 100 years. I then had to admit that we had closed the first new bridge over the River Thames for 100 years. Now, of course, it has triumphantly reopened. What is clear, however, is that the creation of such a remarkable new gallery has had an astonishing impact on the patterns of visitor participation. I well remember that when we were working out the finances of Tate Modern in the run-up to its opening, we boldly estimated that perhaps if we were very lucky, we would see 2 million visitors coming in the first year, but falling off thereafter. In fact, of course, over 5 million came. They were helped by free admission, I'm pleased to say. And whilst the first flush of numbers has since calmed down a bit, there are still far more people coming than anyone had dreamed would be the case. And what is more, the range of people is remarkable in its diversity. As with the Lowry, many come for the architecture rather than the art. But in this case, they stay and look at the content of the building rather than just marvel at the cavernous scale of the Turbine Hall. And they will argue fiercely about what they like and what they hate. But that, of course, is entirely the point. The gallery raises debate and controversy. It engages an audience that reaches far beyond those who are familiar with visits to museums and art galleries. So Tate Modern has succeeded in regenerating an audience. Is it succeeding in regenerating an area around it? That question is still open, but as I indicated a moment or two ago, the signs are hopeful. One word of warning, however. Sometimes, when a cultural quarter develops, either clustered around a major cultural facility, or in many cases without any such catalyst, an all too familiar pattern of development occurs. First, a number of artists move into an area because it has the potential to be an attractive neighbourhood, but rents are cheap. Then small-scale creative entrepreneurs follow. Then the area begins to develop a feeling of being modern, go-ahead, interesting, full of street life and activity. And of course, it begins to become popular. And because of its popularity, it starts to be in much greater demand, and property prices rise, and rental levels go through the roof, and eventually the artists and the creative startup businesses are forced out of the marketplace. It is the sort of phenomenon that has already happened in places like Clerkenwell and Hoxton. I hope it won't happen in Southwark too. One way in which it can be avoided is for active intervention to take place from a benevolent public sector. In Halifax, Sir Ernest Hall showed by private philanthropy what can be achieved by making affordable accommodation available for artists and creative businesses. How about encouraging the London Development Agency to invest in some similar clusters of studios and workshops, making them available at reasonable rents, keeping the equity of the overall building, and seeing at least something of a return on a long-term basis? London, after all, is where the problem is most acute and where the levels of creative activity are at their most intense. I believe this would be a perfect way for a public agency to address a clear case of market failure. The newest addition to the London cultural firmament is the Laban Centre, triumphantly opened just a few weeks ago in Deptford. It is a stunning building, designed by the team that gave us Tate Modern, and it is intended to work both for students and for the public, as well as being an enhancement to the landscape of the area. It is a landscape that needs enhancement. Here, where Henry VIII's navy was built and where Christopher Marlowe was killed, there has been a lot of dereliction for a long time. The Laban Centre will, it is hoped, not only provide a wonderful new home for one of our major dance studios, but will also lead to a wider process of regeneration. Will it succeed in doing so? Can you simply put a wonderful building in the middle of a desolate landscape and expect that something will happen? The answer, I believe, is that such a building will help, but it isn't the complete answer. And everything we know from Salford, Gateshead, St. Ives, and Bankside seems to confirm this. In a moment, I want to turn to the specific example of the South Bank Centre to explore some of these questions further. But let me first turn briefly to two now famous international examples. I first visited Bilbao 18 years ago, when it was a bustling port city with rather a lot of character and a fiesta taking over all the streets in the centre, but hardly a tourist in sight and no Guggenheim Museum. Since then, of course, the city has been changed completely, and certainly the public perception is that this has been achieved largely by the creation of one building. The Geary Museum building is spectacular. It is the sort of architecture that takes your breath away. And incidentally, it was achieved at a cost of something like a fifth of the cost of creating the Millennium Dome. The Guggenheim has brought many additional visitors to the city. It has spawned other artistic projects and other architectural improvements around Bilbao. And again, it represents an example of city and regional government taking some bold decisions and creating something new out of nothing. The transformation is down to visionary public authorities, coupled with dramatic architecture, substantial private philanthropy, and also a sense of commitment from the community as a whole. This last ingredient mustn't be ignored in the search for reasons and motives for regeneration. If Bilbao appears to be a case of regeneration spreading from the top down, Barcelona has, if anything, done it the other way round. There, it has been a bottom-up process, guided by a succession of inspirational mayors, and helped by the presence of the Olympic Games, But the trick they have demonstrated to the world is how you can start with the small things and begin to make a difference that then spreads. They began with changes to the street furniture, the pavements, the notices, the street trees, and the bits of locally sponsored artwork. The major buildings and the wholesale regeneration projects followed later, on the back of the new feel that had already been created. Nowhere has the simple truth been demonstrated so clearly that it is the spaces between the buildings that matter just as much as the individual buildings themselves. So, where among all these different examples do we look for the secrets of success? And how, in particular, do we apply these lessons to the South Bank Centre here in London, which is a classic example of a much-loved cultural institution that is looking its age and is desperately in need of physical improvement? The answer, of course, is that there is no perfect solution that applies in every case. Each example is different, but I believe there are some common themes that emerge. And I believe that four ingredients are needed for success. I want to take these in turn. The art must come first. This is the first and most important lesson to be learned. In contemplating any major cultural development, however much you are hoping for a wider regenerative impact, you must set out with a clear and powerful artistic vision, a sense of how you intend your new building or project to lift people's spirits and their artistic horizons. Get that right, and most of the rest will follow. This, after all, is the bitter lesson we all learned about the dome. The central problem wasn't so much the failure of visitor numbers to reach expectations, though that did indeed have a serious impact on the finances. It was that it started out as a building in search of a content. And that is the wrong way round to develop. The purpose must be clear and must come first. The building then fits around that. What we had at Greenwich was a magnificent building, which has since become a permanent and welcome enhancement to the London skyline. But no one really knew at the outset what it was for. If you're looking for the source of the trail of problems that then ensued, it lies in this simple fact. The South Bank Centre is infinitely better placed, especially in its central building, the Great Festival Hall, that was created as part of the Festival of Britain in 1951. It has a beautiful structure with a clear purpose that has been there since day one. And it was not only designed as a major concert hall, but one that would deliberately beckon people in across the threshold. It is over 50 years old now, and its acoustics trail far behind modern standards. So it is absolutely right that the decision has now been taken to concentrate the first wave of improvement work on the inside of the festival hall and its entrances, and above all, to get the acoustics right. This is the right sense of priorities. Make sure the facility works artistically, and then start thinking about the wider environment. The last few years have seen a succession of different attempts to bring the improvements to the South Bank Centre as a whole that everyone agrees are needed. But whilst there is agreement on the need, there is no such agreement on the form. And at times, it has felt as if the whole of the rest of the nation's cultural infrastructure has been transforming before our very eyes, whilst the dear old South Bank Centre sails on regardless. Part of the reason, I suspect, is that we have tended to forget that central principle of looking at it from the artistic point of view first. Richard Rogers' scheme of a few years ago, aiming to place a gigantic glass wave over the whole concept, was wonderful architecturally and aesthetically, and would probably have created one of the great new public spaces of our city. But I'm not sure that it had the artistic purpose right. Even before the Arts Council ruled against it on grounds of cost, I suspect their doubts about whether it truly added to the quality or quantity of artistic activity had some validity. It was an urban development scheme first, and an artistic scheme second. The same can probably be said about the Rick Mather master plan scheme that succeeded it. It included some ingenious solutions to the space problems of the site, but it always seemed to be the property portfolio that ultimately mattered. I can't blame Rick for this because it was partly forced upon him by the financial exigencies of the situation. But I can't help feeling that it wasn't the best way of addressing the needs and problems of the overall site. There is a real chance now, third time lucky, to get it right. And all the indications are that we're now going to get a step-by-step process, starting with the festival hall, and even more importantly, starting from an understanding of what the artistic needs of the site are, and then thinking through the physical form that those should take. What sizes of concert hall do we need for the musical requirements of the London region population? Do we need two or three? Do the Queen Elizabeth Hall and Purcell Room provide the right kind of space? If not, what precisely might we need in terms of a new concert facility? Should the Hayward Gallery stay in place in view of its undoubted usefulness as a gallery space, or does it have visual drawbacks and make it difficult to attract visitors in? And then after we have answered these sorts of questions, we can begin to address the next series of issues about visual impact and creation of great new public spaces and beautifully designed buildings. Which brings me neatly to the second ingredient for success. The artistic vision may be the first essential ingredient, but the need to get the best possible physical and environmental impact for any development that may take place is almost as important. The look and feel of a place do matter. And if you doubt me on this, just take a look at some of those awful concrete walkways that surround the festival hall. Ugly, desolate, wind-blown, not even terribly convenient, full of dark corners, one of the least welcoming environments for a great concert venue that I know of anywhere in the world. Look at the sweep of the festival hall roof from the river, or at the river from the windows of the People's Palace restaurant inside, and you would think you were in the most magical setting imaginable. Look at the same building from the labyrinth under the walkways, and it seems a completely different place. In due course, the concrete monstrosities that surround the festival hall have to go. The confusing profusion of entrances must be sorted out and clarified. The splendor of the building's setting must be put to better use. The future existence of the Queen Elizabeth Hall and the Purcell Room must be properly debated. The grubby public areas must be transformed into gracious public spaces. The South Bank Centre has the capability to become the jewel in London's artistic crown, but it will never be so whilst its environmental setting is so degraded. The transformation of Hungerford Bridge has shown what can be done, even working with the most unpromising of materials. I'm pleased to say that the Millennium Commission, amongst others, helped to bring about that transformation. And anyone who walks over the new footbridges will know that it was worth doing. Anyone who looks at the bridge from the riverbank will know the same. And in changing both the approach to the festival hall and the river view of the South Bank as a whole, it has had a very positive effect. It is a rather good example of how, with a bit of architectural imagination, an ugly duckling really can be changed into a swan. The third ingredient for successful regeneration is the consideration that has to be given alongside the art and the architecture to the economic activity that can be brought into being at the same time. We shouldn't forget that cultural institutions are not just places where people come to revere art or experience music. They are also places where people are employed, meet, discuss, plan, and do deals. They are places where visitors congregate and spend money. They act as magnets that draw foreign tourists into Britain as a whole. They can have an impact on a surrounding area as a catalyst for cultural enterprise. All of these are important economic factors that sit alongside the more obvious artistic and physical aspects of cultural development. In this respect, the South Bank Centre has a real opportunity. It sits cheek by jowl with other major cultural or leisure facilities, the London Eye, the National Theatre, the BFI, IMAX Cinema. It has better links across the river to the North Bank and places like Somerset House than ever before. If the exciting new ideas about spreading light across the river come to fruition, those links will be even more apparent. So the SBC is not sitting on its own in the middle of a cultural wasteland. There is potentially a powerful synergy here, and it ought to be the case that this can lead more readily to wider economic activity. Some of this has already been springing up around the Coin Street area, but the potential to lead a much-needed economic renaissance of the Waterloo area as a whole, with other parts of North Lambeth and Southwark, needs to be seized. Some of this will happen anyway, without anyone in authority doing anything. But to reach its full potential, it needs to be worked at. And that means everyone, in cultural charge and in public authority and in significant parts of the private sector, working together to bring about the desired outcomes. All too often, those thinking about cultural development forget that it is taking place in the midst of a surrounding community whose views and needs and engagement are just as important as, for example, the audiences you're seeking to attract. This brings me to the fourth vital ingredient. The local community has to be involved, has to be brought on board, and if at all possible, has to be enthused by what you are trying to do. Sometimes there will be inevitable suspicions. Sometimes there will be rows. There will never ever be complete agreement. But dialogue and engagement are crucially important, and they must be actively sought. This is especially true in the case of the South Bank Centre. I first became involved with the local Coin Street community over 20 years ago as a housing specialist working with a range of housing cooperatives across London and the South East. I well remember the way in which the local Waterloo community got together, fought the developers' proposals for massive office block development, wheeled me, amongst others, out to give evidence to the public inquiries, got the GLC as one of its final acts to approve a range of cooperative housing developments along Upper Ground, and has emerged out of all of this as one of the most imaginative and powerful examples of social enterprise in action in Britain today. Any organisation that can take the Oxo Tower, renovate it to its full glory, draw major income from expensive restaurants and bars, and use that in part to rent riverside flats to families in housing need deserves something of an accolade. To think that any future plan for the South Bank Centre can ignore this bubbling ferment of community activity in the immediately surrounding area would be daft. That's why I welcome the involvement that is now developing with the Coin Street community, with the South Bank employers, and with Lambeth Council to discuss the best way forward. There are key flashpoints of discussion. The future of Jubilee Gardens for one, the use of the Hungerford car park site for another. And both are important ingredients for a successful overall development. Jubilee Gardens as they sit at present are a sorry fragment of what they were originally conceived to be, or indeed what they could be. Thinking through how they can be made to be a far more attractive green space for the benefit of the whole area is a task for everyone involved. And discussion of how the green space can relate to the artistic complex that sits beside it, drawing people readily from one environment to the other, needs to take place. And whilst I realise that there are some who argue that the Hungerford car park site should be kept purely as an extension to green open space, I hope that there can be a serious discussion of how, with some degree of extension of the green areas of the park, there can nonetheless be a really attractive contemporary cultural building created on at least part of that site. These are issues that need to be trawled through with the local community, the borough planners, the government office, the arts funders and others. But the community must be engaged, and ensuring that such an engagement happens is one of the very first steps that are needed if there is to be a successful outcome at the end. These then are the essential items to put on Clive Hollick's and Michael Lynch's list in thinking about the way forward for the South Bank. The art first, the architecture and the environment close behind, and the economic impact and the community engagement that you want and need have to be worked for. These principles are true, incidentally, of any such development, and I would argue in any major urban area around the world. It's not an easy task, and it is especially not an easy task in the case of the South Bank. So many different agencies and personnel are involved that I wouldn't blame Michael if he threw up his hands in despair and decamped back to Australia as fast as he could go. I've touched on some of the players a moment ago: the Waterloo community, the Borough of Lambeth, the Government Office for London, the Mayor of London, the Arts Council at national and at London level, the Heritage Lottery Fund, English Heritage, the Department for Culture, Media and Sport, the Office of the Deputy Prime Minister, the major local employers like Shell, the British Film Institute, neighbouring bodies like the London Eye and the National Theatre, private developers and donors. I could add to the list, but you get the picture. Bringing coherence to this range of interested parties would try the patience of a saint. And what must be avoided at all costs is any solution that smacks of being the lowest common denominator that can be found amongst all these players. Ultimately, that will require some people being prepared to make compromises and to reach agreements they don't want to. It will require inspirational leadership that knows what it wants to achieve artistically, environmentally, and economically. And it will need to eschew the natural exasperation that comes from such a long delayed process. But the attempt must be made. This site in the heart of London, in its most important, unimproved location, is too important for that not to be done. I started with Jane Jacobs and her vision of the centrality of human activity and interaction and cultural aspiration. What I think we see as we look at some of these examples from the recent history of our country, and as we consider the South Bank and its current needs, is that great cultural projects can indeed help the Jacobs vision to be achieved. But they are only ultimately part of the overall solution. You need to get the other bits right too: the setting, the feel, the local economy, the surrounding community, the social impact. Get those properly in place alongside the art, and you are well on the way to getting the wider issues of urban living and urban space right too.
Thank you very much indeed, Chris, for that urban ride, I suppose, round the lottery-funded improvements to Britain's, in many cases, older industrial cities. And undoubtedly what we've heard here is a picture, in a sense, of the postmodern stage of the way Britain's industrial past has been dealt with. And undoubtedly these projects have contributed, certainly in the major ones discussed outside London and outside St. Ives, to a major attempt to do something about what was left with the industrial areas in the centre or near the centre of major cities in the Midlands and the North. We're going now to have a brief comment or commentary from the man who has bravely taken on the grubby public areas and the degraded environment. Because sitting here to my right is Michael Lynch, who is the chief executive, the relatively new chief executive of the South Bank Centre, and therefore the inheritor of this environment and that list of organisations champing at the bit to make life difficult. He has previously been the chief executive of the Sydney Opera House, one of the world's great cultural icons, and an example of how the world can add to its stock of great icons with modern architecture and a modern artistic enterprise with both a building and activity inside. He was also general manager of the Australia Council, the equivalent of the Arts Council in Australia, and therefore is presumably used to large numbers of people actively disliking him. Anyway, you've very kindly agreed, well, it's certainly what the poor people who run the Arts Council here discover anyway, that everybody who they give money to likes them till they stop and everybody else does. Anyway, Michael Lynch, whichever you feel more comfortable, wherever you feel more comfortable.
Thank you, Tony, and thank you, Chris. I guess Chris just makes it, sort of almost too easy for me, because I kept on writing down agree. Why did I, sort of want to say anything? I really appreciate the opportunity, and I think that was a really important piece of work that, Chris has put out, and certainly makes my task somewhat easier in terms of trying to grapple with all those wonderfully enunciated problems. And I guess, sort of one now wants to try and, sort of grapple with some of the solutions. My wife said to me when I took on this task, why are you going from one of the world's most beautiful buildings to what is one of the ugliest? I said, and she wasn't just talking, I think she was really not talking about the building, because after a number of trips here, I sort of absolutely agree with Chris in regard to the centrality of Royal Festival Hall, what a fantastic building it is, built at the couple of months after me, surviving a lot better, I think, in terms of what it's able to do. But I think we're at a really interesting point in terms of the journey. I think there's just too many things. I don't, in a short period of time, I must agree that where I think things have gone wrong is that we didn't get the art first. And the great thing about Royal Festival Hall, the reason it is held in such extraordinary affection by people across the world, and why people come there in, and I'd have to say, despite in all the doom and the gloom, we've just had the most successful year we've ever had. So I think the reason I came was that I could see an upside, and probably it was sort of an innate optimism or the idea of being able to take on a challenge that that lay around the South Bank that convinced me to move from the Opera House to this place. I don't think we've ever articulated, and I still don't think we've articulated what we're about in terms of the art and in terms of what spaces we need to do it. I think when it was built in 1951, it was an extraordinary statement of modernism, but it was also an extraordinary statement about the relevance of the arts to everybody, not just to the elites. And I suppose I spent a large part of my life working in arts institutions that tried to redefine their relationship with the society in which they were in. And that included the Sydney Opera House, which was, we reckon probably 10% of the people of Sydney would come there on a regular basis. And over the course of the time I was there, I think we made some substantial shifts in the composition of that audience. And the way you have to do that was really based on the things that Royal Festival Hall had been doing for a very long period of time. The engagement with the outside world, the engagement with free things, the idea of making it a centre for ideas, for discussion, getting over the problems, the fact that it is an illegible site, that it's an inhospitable environment, and that the venues themselves now are somewhat off the pace. But I think that probably is the thing that needs most to inform us about what we do now. We've obviously come in late in terms of the cycle. We missed a number of opportunities, but I think what we now get, picking up all of those points that Chris made, is an opportunity to redefine what we want to do for 2025 and beyond in the way that those people who had the foresight to put it there in 1951, we need to have that same sort of foresight, that same sort of engagement, And that particular engagement, I think, both with the community in which we sit, which we've been very bad at in terms of, I think, you know, sort of finding the ways to move forward, but also with the artistic community, and then find the ways to be able to pick it up and to move it forward. I'm really excited, and I'm probably more excited today by what in the way that Chris has laid this out, because I think in making the decisions that we focus on getting a Royal Festival Hall that will be still relevant in 2025 as the first step in the regeneration, at the same time looking at the role that Jubilee Gardens plays, and that we do that in a different way than the way that I think we've been approaching it in the past, that we do actually pick up our connection with the community, how we work with the community, how the community views us, is a really important step forward. And I think we've learned some lessons by talking to the community and through a close engagement with the political process, through the bad bits and through the good bits, that we've now proposed that Jubilee Gardens be done not by us, not as part of a parlaying piece in terms of getting approval for the Hungerford car park site, which sits alongside Royal Festival Hall, but as a genuine way of saying that we have changed, we want to be part of the regeneration of the broad community. We want to be able to find ways to take advantage of things like the BA London Eye and the £34 million of business that is coming there now after only 2 years. And I think that's a very important lesson that we had got wrong, and that hopefully we can now move forward. There have been moments of, bleakness over the course of my last 5 months, none more so than when we were greeting the community and talking about the proposals for Jubilee Gardens. And I made a comment in regard to the future of the park that it was a bit hard to get round some of this extraordinary complex of stakeholders and the extraordinary approval processes, and that it was a bizarre thing to have control of the grass in Jubilee Gardens, but that someone else had a covenant on the subsoil, and that was only Margaret Thatcher could have divined the solution, which said, you get the grass and you get the bit underneath the grass and try and work out how you turn it into a world-class park. I'm still grappling with a few of those issues, but I think with the support of a number of other players, we're probably in a much better position to be able to do that. I also think the challenge for us as an organisation is that we need to be thinking about what we're going to be like in 2025. And so for any of the recent LSE graduates, I'm looking for a COO who's going to be able to both send me back at an appropriate time and find a way to make sure that this wonderful cultural institution that the South Bank Centre is and has been, and I believe will be able to continue to be, can be put back into the hands of one of yours, one of them, one of ours. I think tonight, it's been, I won't go on, because I think it's really important that you get the opportunity to engage with Chris and to ask questions or to make comments. For me, it's been a really important opportunity to gain the benefit of Chris's insights over a long period of engagement, and it was certainly something that when he came to Australia and I took him around the Opera House during the Olympics, I had never envisaged that not only would I finish up back here running one of your cultural institutions, but that I would also be able to get such a valuable inspiration for the journey. So a saint I ain't, but I'm hopefully going to be able to pick up some of the wonderful clues that he's given me today, and the opportunity to hopefully lead this organisation with a lot of support, both internally and externally, into its a period where we start looking at it for the good things about it, the great programming, it's the reputation it has, the affection that artists have for it, to be able to match that with its physical environment and to continue to be able to attract the audiences. So on that note, I'll hand back to Chris.
Thank you very much, Jim. Thank you, Michael. Now, we've got about 20 minutes or so in which you can ask questions either of Chris Smith or of Michael Lynch, indeed, about the question of culture and regeneration more generally, or obviously about South Bank and its future. So would anybody like to kick the questioning off? I have my own, but don't let me intrude. Very good, and perhaps in the best of the time-honoured traditions, you could say broadly who you are and broadly where you come from, just for the courtesy of the responders.
Yes, hi, my name's Dominic Palfreman, and I'm not anything to do with the LSE. I'm here because I'm interested in the cultural field in general. I have a question, well, it's more of a statement, but I'd like to see your reaction to it, which is that in the Opera House in Sydney is, in fact, a very different model from the South Bank Centre, and I don't see how you see the two together at all. I see the Opera House in Sydney as very much like the Opera House in Manaus in Brazil. It's a cultural statement that we have an elite rather than a populist democratic statement which we are going to involve people in our cultural life, which is what the South Bank Centre is. And I think that the tension between creating a cultural touchstone and somewhere that is necessarily elitist because of that and something which is popular is the big problem with this whole regeneration idea.
I don't agree. I think the Opera House in Sydney is a major community focus, and I think that has a great similarity to the South Bank. It has 5 theatres, so it's not just an opera house. Its major events are the outdoor events, whether they be the Olympic Games, in terms of the cultural side of it, or the other activities that take place around it. That's one example. It was the centrepiece for the Millennium celebrations in Sydney. It is the major focus for a whole range of community activity, whether it be New Year's Eve or whatever else. So I actually think there's quite a lot of similarities between the broader South Bank, not just the bit that I have responsibility for, but the broad area that runs from the Eye almost through Corn Street down towards the Tate. I think that there is a huge opportunity for creating those synergies between the cultural players that sit there and then the community and the other things. And I guess that was one of the attractions of coming. Obviously you've got the benefit of a fantastic building in Sydney and the fact that it's a tourist icon, but in many ways that the site that South Bank occupies does create that similar sort of draw. But I'd be interested in Chris's view.
I mean, in some ways the South Bank does straddle, doesn't it, the divide between being a popular, in the wider sense of the word, popular institution and an elite institution. I mean, it is in some ways doing both. Is that fair to say that?
Absolutely fair to say that. Both in terms of of the overall nature of the place. In the festival hall, it is a great concert hall, give or take an acoustic or two. But it's also a place where people like to come and throng and potter and browse and all those sort of things. So it manages to combine those two roles in a way which very few other places, and the Lowry is one example, but very few other places have yet managed to do so. And certainly, sadly, as yet, Covent Garden hasn't managed to do that, although it's a little bit of the way down the road to doing it with more free events happening and screens in the piazza and so on. The Festival Hall does it in its programme. Yeah, it'll have Shirley Bassey on one night, and it'll have a relatively obscure classical music concert on another. Good on them for doing that and for mixing the way in which it attracts people in, because there is crossover and it helps to cross-fertilise between different cultural experiences.
It's fair to say its origins were very much in a kind of socialist sort of art is good for the masses, if I can summarise it as that sort of view of the world, weren't they, in the 50s?
I'd slightly redefine that as art is good to be opened up for the masses to choose to enjoy.
Okay, fine. All right. Okay, I'll take Andy then one and then two in the middle there, Andy. Person here.
Hi, Andy Pratt. I run the Cities Space and Society Masters Programme here. I'm just wondering what your reflections are, really, that you've spoken a lot, in a way, both of you, about focusing these buildings, about consumption spaces in a variety of ways. Maybe not as in the sort of grosser sense of retail consumption spaces, although those things get tacked onto art institutions these days, but about the way that we consume culture and art. And I wonder about the connections with production as well. I mean, I know, obviously, there are cultural productions there, but about the broader sense of the production of art and culture that somehow gets divorced from these institutions, or at least is a poorer partner in that. And if one is to be putting art and culture at the centre as the rationale, as the wherewithal for these places, maybe it's that sort of sustainability that may get lost in some of these places. Now, obviously, institutions play a variety of roles, and these may sit in a national setting. But one wonders, in these regeneration settings, whether it's about the consumption space that probably has become more important rather than the production, and we lose sense of some of those elements. I wonder if you have any reactions to that.
One go each here. Do you want to start?
Well, I see the point. I'm not sure it's entirely valid. I would, for example, say, go down to Tate Modern and look at the Anish Kapoor sculpture that's there at the moment. That is something which was specifically designed to be fitted into that building, but it is a great piece of modern sculpture. And whether you look at it from the point of view of the very large numbers of people who flocked in to see it, or from the point of view of Anish Kapoor making the sculpture in the first place and playing with the space and seeing it as a production opportunity for him, it seems to me that now, you won't get that everywhere, but very frequently in some of these great new contemporary spaces that we've created, yes, I suspect that the way in which they were sold to the funders and the public and so on was all about consumption, but they happen to be, in many cases, good for producers of art and culture as well.
I'd just say, look at the hundreds of things that happen in the Purcell Room, the Queen Elizabeth, the free spaces there, where there are artists doing their work for the consumption is really not the issue. We try and make it as accessible as we possibly can. So there's a lot of production happening alongside a fair bit of consumption. But if you ain't got the consumption, you're not going to have the production.
And I mean, Andy's point, there is a way in which the debate about the South Bank Centre has been driven by the need to get consumers in there, or indeed to place consumption in the shape of retailing in there to make the thing viable, because this isn't France and the state doesn't simply come along and dollop money into it. One way or another, it has to be a consumerist place, and that does dominate the debate rather than the production value.
I just wanted to add another dimension to that as well. I mean, it's the reflection on the Guggenheim in Bilbao, for example, is the sort of growing tension there between the region and the city, and because the region is partly funding it with its taxes as well in terms of resources, and about what the people in the region get from that building, and particularly where you have quite a strong disjuncture there between the sort of types of artistic consumption that might be relevant in the, or general in the region, apart from the city. Mainly tourists are going in there, basically. So there's a potential legitimation problem, in a way, for a city body promoting a type of art, and then legitimation in terms of who's paying for it, and is this the art for everybody, or an art for a particular group?
Indeed, just to say that, I'll stop interrupting, but the director of the Baltic has been criticised for saying that he's not interested that much, or he's giving the impression he's not interested that much in the consumerist part of
The problem is, of course, you can't win. If you place too much emphasis in one direction, you get criticised by the others and vice versa. And of course, in Bilbao, you also have the wonderful overlay of all the complexities of Basque politics in relation to what's happening there. I would just remark in passing that one of the issues about Bilbao is that the Guggenheim Museum is a wonderful space externally. It's a more difficult space internally. It is actually quite a good example of where you have an architect who is playing with the form of a building rather than thinking all the time about how the space inside was going to be used. It's a mild criticism because it is such a fabulous building, but that's the way it was created. The producer-consumer point, don't forget that in the festival hall, one of the reasons why, absolutely the first thing that they need to do is to sort out the acoustics, is that that's important not just for the audience, but even more importantly, it's important for the people who are performing in the festival hall. And everyone who has ever performed in the festival hall tells me that it is a complete nightmare to be on the stage trying to make music and understand what sound is emerging out of what you're doing. So getting that right, it's all about production.
Okay, one here. We'll do this as democratically and quickly as possible. One here, one there, and then another one emerging towards the back, and another one right far back. Okay.
I come belatedly from a seminar, but I'd like to raise an issue which I believe is quite beyond the remit of this evening. It involves a comparison between the Barbican and the South Bank Center, and it's a management question. The Barbican has the advantage of being able to promote across the whole range of live performance, whereas the South Bank Center, for example, notably, for understandable reasons, does not include the theater. It is always a handicap to me that South Bank Center really should be considered as englobing also the theater for some sort of step jump, quantum jump to a better kind of synergy. Surely there must be some way of affecting, bringing about a greater degree of synergy. The Barbican does not suffer from this.
Also the advantage of one owner, of course.
Yes, indeed. I guess from my point of view, I think the entity of the South Bank is more important than the entity of the South Bank Centre. And so the relationships that exist between the National, the BFI, and our constituent parts is one of the things that I would see as a way of building both the benefits for all of the constituencies, but also creating that sense. I'm not in competition with the Barbican, I'm in competition with the West End and football. And they're the only parts that I'm really concerned about. If the Barbican is able to do lots of things in a good way, I think we're able to do a lot of other things. And if we can share those benefits along the riverfront, that'll be create the sort of the regeneration, but it will also create the benefits for the local community. It'll create the opportunities for the artists, and it will build robust cultural institutions that can probably do more themselves in terms of determining what their future is going to be, and then replace whether we, if we need to look at the future life of buildings, do something about that.
Yes, but I'm not the business community to do this joint promotion across the whole thing.
I think the cultural institutions has got to work closer together. That's probably a lesson I would bring from another place.
I'd certainly agree with more close working together, and I have to declare an interest as a member of the board of the National Theatre in this. What I don't think you would necessarily gain by is having a single management over National Theatre and South Bank Centre all together and National Film Theatre and so on. Having dedicated expert management for the music, for the theatre and so on, I think actually is sensible. But coordinate the marketing between all of them and so on, yes, of course.
Okay, thanks. Down here.
Yes, I'm a PhD student here at NSU, and I listened with much interest to your hierarchization of objectives from art institution or from institutions to promote art. And I was wondering, I had two questions. One is, how do you enforce this hierarchy of goals? And the second one is, how you ensure the accountability of the responsible bodies that when they make mistakes, when they don't have the they don't have this hierarchy, then they are held accountable for what's happening. I'd like to give one example, and if I can maybe elaborate a little bit on this, is I have the impression that over the past few, I don't know how many years, maybe art is given up at the expense of the two other goals that you you presented. One example is I like to mention is the one related to museums and how they've expanded and how they broaden the appeals to the general public and how also the urban impact and environmental impact, economic impact has also become very important. And my example is related to the restoration of works of art and how they impact the artistic value of paintings in museum. This is my example. And this promotes the appeal that these paintings have to the general public and helps this surroundings of museums to develop, but at the expense of the art. So I'd like to ask whether, if there's anything to be done about it and whether your goals can be really enforced, because there's a political economy of art and the promotions of art which is here, and I don't see how the UK is not very bad, but it's a prime example of what's happening, it seems to me, particularly with respect to a few big museums here, and okay. I feel that this heritage which is at stake at the moment.
Thank you very much. Now, the conflict particularly between, in a sense, the sort of regeneration and open to the public part of the arts world and the, what I take it, the curatorial sort of preserve. You must have met this regularly, a Secretary of State, Douglas before and after.
Well, at heart, I suspect it's the debate between wider access on the one hand and excellence on the other, and whether you can have the two. And my answer to that would be you have to have the two, and they actually go hand in hand together, and they feed off each other. They don't destroy each other. If you have wonderful things happening artistically, there must be an impulse to share that as widely as possible, as many people as possible who can derive benefit from that. And if you've got lots of people engaged, that doesn't mean that you should downgrade the quality of what it is you're showing to. You have to maintain quality. You can do both, and I think museums are an absolutely clear case in point. I remember when I was pushing doggedly through all the government processes that I had to do in order to restore free admission to the National Museums and Galleries, there were some people who said, putting free admission back in place is going to bring lots of extra people into these museums. It is going to destroy the precious stillness that we have at the moment to enjoy these works of art. Now, if you want just a select few people in reverential quietness to enjoy the great paintings and works of art and scientific and historical artifacts that we have in this country, then fine, make that argument. I don't happen to agree with it.
Politicians probably wouldn't get the resources in the very long term. Now, there was a question, that's right, and then somebody, there were a couple behind you, I'm afraid. So let's try and take three together, so make them short, because time is running short. One, then two, then three, and that may have to be it. Yep.
Evi Banitopoulou, researcher at the London Institute. It was interesting to hear that the artistic aspect has to come first in future regeneration plans. But I was wondering how the groups of politicians, managers, economists, etc., who have long been in favour of the financial aspects of regeneration with regards to culture would be influenced or indeed persuaded to do something different from now on, and whether you would be in favour of what a lot of management institutes are doing nowadays around Europe, I don't know about America, where they call a lot of people involved in the arts to specially train managers that are going to work in the youth generation field.
Okay. Right, and then there was a guy at the back and then one just more or less in front of him. I'll keep them short.
Yes, I'd like to suggest possibly a fifth...
So could you say who you are?
My name's Geoffrey Marsh. I run a small arts consultancy. I'd like to suggest there's possibly a fifth idea for success to add to the four that were raised. And I'd just like to illustrate a very short story, which was that I was responsible as a project director for doing the Imperial War Museum in the North. And what happened on that project was that when it didn't receive any lottery funding, the man who was going to sell us the site for £2.5 million changed his view and in fact gave us the site and also gave us £10 million. So he gave us £12.5 million. That person's never been thanked publicly. When the New Year's Honours List came out this year, I thought, here's someone who's actually put his hand in his pocket. And I think as a society, if we're not prepared to acknowledge people who do support these projects, we shouldn't be surprised when people give us a handful of change. And I also think that if we can't do it at that sort of level, what is it to encourage the sort of people who can afford £30,000, £40,000, £50,000 to donate to projects? The sort of people who just end up at the bottom of the donors board where it says, and a lot of other donors. And I think I'd like to ask the panel, A, if they agree with that, but B, if they have any thoughts about how, as a society, we could acknowledge some of the people who are actually helping to bring these projects into being.
Yes, I'm just generally, I'm Chillingford, by the way. I have a general interest in, and have been very concerned. I'm not an architect or have any leanings on that side, but on the question of the questionable regeneration that we have here, the speaker mentioned the arts and culture should force the pace. And that sort of nodded me a little bit in terms of what was mentioned earlier, the socialist concept. I just wondered why shouldn't arts and culture force the pace and have a less bureaucratic or compromise among the agencies of change and have something more of a, like the Bilbao effect, for instance. Less cowardice and more inclusive design for people's use rather than the architect's vanity and status for proper projects that are planned with an inclusive infrastructure. And that is, for example, for the future architects who happen to be here or who have proposals for the future design of inner city areas.
So wider remit from that traditionally accepted.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Chris, do you want to pick up those and perhaps Michael, if you want to say something?
First of all, the question about, or two-headed question really, about the politics of getting the finance in place for this. And whenever I went to talk to Gordon Brown when I was Secretary of State, I have to confess, I didn't say it's the art that comes first. I talked about the educational value of what was happening. I talked about economic regeneration. I talked about employment opportunities. And occasionally I talk about keeping the arts lobby quiet. And those were political arguments that I was using in order to extract substantial sums of money from him, and it worked. That doesn't mean that I didn't all the while believe that the art came first, but you shape your arguments according to the purpose, the noble purpose for which you're striving. On the sort of training of managers for the arts, and one of the things it's a peculiarly British phenomenon actually, that we actually in Britain do very little training of people to run arts organisations and institutions, and yet we happen to have produced some of the outstanding directors of museums and theatres and so forth anywhere in the world. I say that because one is sitting down in the front row. It's not because we try, and I think we ought to try more. And there are some rather exciting moves afoot to put in place a foundation that may well help to ensure precisely this, that in looking to the directors of museums and theatres and arts organisations of the future, we may be more proactive as a country about consciously trying to create a cadre of people who will be able to take on those sort of leadership roles. On the question about private donors, and the Imperial War Museum of the North example is an astonishing example of philanthropy on a major scale. I think two things we need to do. One is we need to make the tax regime in this country more psychologically attractive to the giver. In fact, in strict terms, the tax incentives that exist in the UK are more or less the same for private giving to charitable artistic institutions as they are in the United States. However, the psychology is completely different because it's the receiving institution that claims the tax rebate. It's not the donor who gets the tax rebate. So whereas in America, you simply write down on your tax return, I have given $200 to the San Francisco Opera, and immediately your tax liability goes down by $200. Here, you give your $200 to the opera. That's it. That comes out of your income. The opera then is able to go to the Inland Revenue and get an additional £80 or whatever, $80 out of the trade. The psychology is completely wrong. And we need to think about, I suspect we'll never get this through the Inland Revenue, but it's worth a try to try and get that change. The other thing we need to do is to recognise, we recognise the big donors. We put Gerwood's name up in lights everywhere. But what we don't do is recognise the small donors terribly well. And there are ingenious schemes. I think the British Museum Great Court was the best, actually, where you by making a donation of, I think it was £99 or £100, you would have one of the panels of the roof of the Great Court named after you, and your name would be inscribed in a great book, and you could choose which panel you wanted to have named after you. And you could give this as a gift to people and so on. And it worked. People were queuing up to donate money in order to do this. It was a very imaginative way of just giving people a little bit of recognition for the donation they were making.
I've got a lot of bricks too that I can great blocks
and blades of grass in Jubilee Gardens.
I wouldn't encourage too many people.
And the final question, which is about architects and planning for inclusivity rather than just what the architect feels on a whim like doing. Yes, absolutely. But what I don't want to erase from the equation is the ability of architects to be completely off-the-wall inspirational when they want to. Yes, they then have to go through a rigorous process of thinking, will this building work? Will it work for all the people who could conceivably want to use it? But starting with the inspirational ideas, I think, is part of the creativity of the architectural process.
A couple of quick bits. The tax system in America, which was invented in 1913, has always given the advantages to them. So you've got about 80, 90 years of tradition to catch up on, and that made a huge difference. It's only ever been abolished once in terms of individual giving in America. Ronald Reagan did it for 18 months, and the contributions being given to the arts and the charitable sector dropped by 85%. So, sort of just bear that in mind, keep the pressure on the politicians and, try and keep the balance up. In regard to the building question, I think, great buildings can be created that can do all sorts of great things. Sydney would not be the city it is today if it hadn't got the Opera House. I firmly believe that, having lived in it all my life. And in regard to recognising
people, I think it's a really fundamental issue. I've got to raise £20 million to, you know, bring Royal Festival Hall off. You know, I will do all sorts of things, you know, within the law and within, you know, to be able to do that and to make sure that it happens. But I still fundamentally believe it's really important that, you know, we have to find ways to be able to recognise it. The Americans probably go over the top the other way, and it's the line that you strike in between that, you know, sort of gives the appropriate recognition. I haven't heard your story, and that's, you know, an interesting one.
Okay. It is, we're going to have to stop, I'm sorry. I mean, you may be able to catch the speakers briefly before they leave. I'd like to, on all our behalf, to thank both Michael Lynch as respondent, but particularly Chris Smith, who I should also have added is an academic in his own right, and distinguished and has a background in universities as well as the one we know about more publicly. So I'd like to thank both of our speakers tonight, but particularly Chris Smith, who has maintained the tradition of the Jane Jacobs Lectures, and indeed of she after whom the lectures are named, thinking about cities, thinking about urban spaces and what makes them work. So perhaps once more I can just thank you, Chris. And,